Okay, good morning. My name is Lance Rodewald. I'm with Nancy Pisano, and she and I are going to co-moderate this session called Immunization Programs Looking Forward. And we are really thrilled and fortunate to have two of the leaders from the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. The first speaker will be Melinda Wharton, who's the Deputy Director of NCIRD. And Nancy will get to introduce our second mystery guest over here, who most of you all know as Gary Urquhart. So. Melinda Wharton is the Deputy Director for the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. I think she is somebody who absolutely needs no introduction. She has been doing immunizations for her career, starting off at least in NIP as the chief of the branch that dealt with childhood vaccine-preventable diseases, and then as the Division Director for Epidemiology and Surveillance Division that really helped set policy for the National Immunization Program and did all of the disease surveillance, and then as the Deputy Director for the entire program. So we are very fortunate to have Melinda here to talk about immunization programs looking forward, and she'll be talking a lot about the Section 317 program. So with that, let's welcome Melinda.
Thanks very much. Can we get the slides up? So it's a very exciting time for all of us in public health as we think about the implications of health reform and what that's going to mean for our work going forward. And the value of immunization as a very important preventive service was clearly recognized in the health reform legislation that was passed last year. And with that comes a real opportunity to, I think, solve one of the big problems that we all have faced in immunization, and that's the problem of the underinsured. But so I didn't put any detail on this because I knew Dr. Hinman was going to be sitting on the front row, and I was likely to get it wrong. But the gist of it, and but the 317 program has been around for decades, and although the actual priorities for the program evolved some over time as new vaccines were introduced into the childhood program or priorities shifted, but it always was a safety net. And this was an era when vaccines were fewer and not so expensive, and thanks to 317 and probably other public dollars as well, if a family couldn't afford vaccines, they could go to the health department and likely receive those valuable preventive services for their child. Where we learned that this patchwork of a system wasn't adequate to protect our children from vaccine-preventable diseases really was that wake-up call that came with the 1989 through 1991 measles epidemic in the United States, where, among other things, we learned that this patchwork of referral was leading to missed opportunities, that financial barriers were real for families, particularly poor families with young children, and that we were not managing to get children vaccinated on time, leading susceptibility, which we then saw play out in these measles epidemics that occurred in many parts of the United States during that time. Out of the measles resurgence of 1989 through 1991 came the Vaccines for Children program. VFC was created by the 1993 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act and really became operative the following year. And as probably everyone in this room knows, the program provides federally purchased vaccine for eligible children through age 18, and eligible children are those who are eligible for the Medicaid program, who are uninsured, who are American Indian or Alaskan Native, or for the underinsured in federally qualified health centers or rural health centers. The legislation gives the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices the authority to determine the vaccines that are included in the VFC program, and this has been a really important component of VFC going forward, because as new vaccines were licensed and recommended for children for routine use, we were able to add them to the VFC program without the kind of delays that had happened before VFC in terms of obtaining the funding for public sector purchase of new vaccines as they were added. Because it was a federal entitlement program once those ACIP votes took place, we have been able very consistently to add the newer vaccines to the VFC program. But one thing which VFC left us with was the problem of the underinsured. That was the gap that was left after VFC took care of the problem of meeting the immunization needs of children on Medicaid and the uninsured children. It left the issue of the underinsured not fully addressed. There was the provision in VFC that underinsured children, that is children who are covered by private insurance, that doesn't cover all the costs of recommended vaccines. There was the provision that they were VFC eligible if they received services in federally qualified health centers or rural health centers. And this was I think seen by the creators of the VFC legislation as an effort to address this issue. Because of the nature of health services delivered in those health centers where they really provide comprehensive primary care to their patients and are not well situated to simply provide immunization services to underinsured people, and as well as their geographic distribution and overall capacity, it really didn't fully address the problem. And so even with VFC, their issues remained with coverage of the underinsured. And of course, you know, there are many families who don't have full coverage under insurance, but can make the deductibles or the lack of coverage for immunization services don't present an insurmountable barrier. They can pay the costs out of pocket and receive services in the private sector. But for some families, these out-of-pocket costs represent a significant financial burden and an economic barrier to vaccination. And that's been the problem we've been left with since VFC was implemented. Now, these are data from the 2007 National Immunization Survey looking at children 19 to 35 months of age. And almost half the children in that age group in that survey were entitled to VFC. Within that VFC eligible population, I think it's less than 1% actually received immunizations through the VFC program as underinsured children at federally qualified health centers or rural health centers. There's a good slice, I think it's around 30% that were fully insured, and around an underinsured population that's about 10% of the total. So the underinsured is a significant group, and of that underinsured group, a small proportion actually end up receiving immunizations at health departments. In addition to providing vaccines for the underinsured through 317, we really look to 317 to provide operations funding to make our programs work. These funds provide critical support for the people and systems that really provide the structure that can deliver immunizations and make sure we do what we can do with these life-saving interventions. So there's a list of things on the slide, but it could be, you know, two or three times as long in terms of what all these functions are. There's recruiting immunization providers. There's quality assurance and provider education. There's surveillance and for vaccine-preventable disease in response to outbreaks. There's the important opportunities we have in immunization information systems. There's assessment for vaccine coverage. There's vaccine safety. And the list could be much longer than that. Even if on the public side we didn't buy a dose of vaccine, there would still be those responsibilities even if all of our vaccine purchase were in the private sector, because we still, as public health, need to make sure that we have a full program that fulfills all these functions. Importantly, our 317 operations funding not only helps us deliver our 317 funded program, but it's critical for the implementation of the Vaccines for Children program. The infrastructure that 317 has built over the years is really what makes it possible for us to deliver the Vaccines for Children, the vaccines through the Vaccines for Children program that are so important for that almost half the children in the United States. So that's sort of where things were. And then beginning around 2000, there were a series of new and more expensive vaccines that have been added to our recommended childhood immunization schedule. And of course, these vaccines have been wonderfully effective and have had great impact on health. We've seen some of those data at this conference. We've seen them in previous conferences. It's been spectacularly effective, and that's great. It also has had some disruptive impact on some aspects of the program that maybe were not obvious that these things were going to happen. So if you look at the second of the stacked bars, the 2000 bar, you can see that reddish-brown slice, which is the introduction of pneumococcal conjugate vaccine into the childhood program, a vaccine that's had terrific impact on the incidence of invasive pneumococcal disease in both children and adults, but it also resulted in a large increase in what it costs to vaccinate a child beginning in 2000. So with addition of these new and more expensive vaccines to our immunization program, there have been some effects that perhaps weren't at least obvious that were going to take place. For private immunization providers, there was the need for an upfront investment to stock these new and more expensive vaccines. And for some providers, they didn't wish to make it, or they simply couldn't from the fiscal point of view. It was something that wasn't possible from a business point of view for them to do. And there also is uncertainty, especially at the beginning, about the rate of reimbursement that private insurers would provide to cover these new, more expensive vaccines. And so given the upfront costs and the reimbursement uncertainties, some providers made decisions that they weren't going to offer these new, more expensive vaccines to their well-insured private patients, especially initially, until some of the uncertainty got settled out. So even well-insured patients might end up being directed to public health to receive some of these new, more expensive vaccines. On the public sector side, as the need grew, the Vaccines for Children program grew too. It was an entitlement, and as vaccines were recommended, were added to the program, VFC grew to meet that need. But the Section 317 funding that we relied on to help meet this gap of the underinsured didn't. The program has had great support from a whole variety of partners, as well as from Congress, but Section 317 funding really remained pretty static over time and certainly didn't grow at the rate that the need did to meet the gap that we still had in the program with the underinsured. At the same time, with introduction of these new vaccines, there were more complex program needs that had to be addressed. So there were new providers who had to be recruited. With vaccination of adolescents, we needed to think about what providers saw kids in that age group, and it might be OBGYNs and not pediatricians who needed to be recruited as immunization providers. There were new age groups you had to be focused on. There were new surveillance systems that had to be developed. There were new coverage assessments to look at these new age groups and to look at these new vaccines. There were professional education needs to deal with new diseases, new vaccines, new schedules, and new communication needs as we dealt with a very complex environment on the communication front. So as we have had the opportunity to prevent more vaccine-preventable diseases, the program certainly has become more complex, and there's nothing about this that has made things simpler to do. We can be more efficient, but we still have real needs for this immunization infrastructure to address this complex series of issues. So where we are with our 317 vaccine funding, I'm sure the mix of how our immunization grantees use this funding differ a little bit from grantee to grantee, but certainly the primary use for it, I think, remains underinsured children. We have learned from our billing projects that there are insured children who present to health departments and do end up getting vaccinated with 317 vaccine funding, and this is the issue we're working to address with our billing projects that we've initiated under ERA. Of course, some programs were doing this long before we funded the ERA projects, but it's an issue that we know we need to address. 317 has also played important roles in outbreak control, and we think that that's an ongoing need. And, of course, there always was the flexibility to use 317 vaccine dollars to fund vaccine purchase for adults, But because of the great needs among children, this wasn't something that most programs were able to make much of an investment in. So fast forward to 2010, when the Affordable Care Act is passed. And although there's some uncertainties around how some of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act will be implemented, there is a provision about availability of ACIP-recommended vaccines that is pretty clearly written into the law. And that is that new health insurance plans must provide coverage for ACIP-recommended vaccines without deductibles or copays when delivered by an in-network provider. This pertains to new plans, and so for existing plans, this requirement doesn't apply to them until significant changes are made in the plan, and then they cease being what's called grandfathered or covered, or not having this law apply to them. But as they lose their grandfathered status, they will be considered new plans and also have to provide coverage for ACIP-recommended vaccines without deductibles or copays when delivered by an in-network provider. There's still some uncertainties around the law, but with full implementation over the next several years, as existing plans lose their grandfathered status, we expect that the problem of the underinsured should largely be solved. Of course, at the same time, we expect the Affordable Care Act to really take care of this problem of the underinsured, there's the other problem, which is the state of the federal budget. And just as we know, states and localities have been under enormous budget pressure recently. The federal government is too. There's great pressure to decrease federal spending. And there is the expectation that the need for Section 317 vaccine purchase will decrease because of the Affordable Care Act. If you put it all together, if the number of underinsured people decreases or ceases to be there completely over the next few years, then the need to provide vaccines for the underinsured should be greatly reduced. Now, that doesn't mean there's not ongoing needs, and that's really why we're having this conversation right now. But in terms of the underinsured, the expectation is that those needs will be greatly reduced or eliminated. So looking forward, what's going to be left after the Affordable Care Act addresses the needs of the underinsured? Well, there's still the problem of uninsured adults, and there still will be uninsured adults after full implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And there still are ongoing needs to maintain preparedness and to respond to outbreaks. So we certainly see that there will continue to be a need for 317 vaccine dollars, even if we no longer need to provide vaccines to the underinsured. And, of course, there's an ongoing need for operations funds for our increasingly complex programs. So this is something that we're going to need to continue to be able to explain the need for. So once the dust is all settled, where we should end up is a continued system based on shared responsibility between public and private sectors. And this really has been the model we've had for immunization in the United States from the beginning of our program. For the insured, insurance should assure access to ACIP-recommended vaccines for both children and adults. The problem of the underinsured should be solved. And VFC will continue to provide vaccines for uninsured children, children eligible for Medicaid, and American Indian and Alaskan Native children. And at that point, our gap, really, in terms of populations, is going to be uninsured adults. And we hope that that is a role that our 317 vaccine dollars can continue to fill. So if we think about adult immunization going forward, most adults should have access to ACIP-recommended adult vaccines through insurance without deductibles or copays once the Affordable Care Act is fully implemented. So one of our challenges is really helping to make that happen. And if we don't have to buy the vaccine, if private insurance is paying for the vaccine, then we're really thinking about partnerships with all the different groups that can help make sure that that those who have insurance, either through public or private sector, really can get ACIP-recommended vaccines. So we're thinking about partnerships with retail pharmacies, workplaces, Medicaid, hospitals, federally qualified health centers, those kinds of places that can help make this happen. At the same time, we envision an ongoing role for the public sector through public health venues to deliver vaccines to other parts of the population. And for those of you who saw the draft funding opportunity announcement or saw the one that was posted this morning at 7:30 on grants.gov, some of this will look familiar. We do hope that we'll be able to address some of these issues through prevention and public health funding this fiscal year, and that funding opportunity has just been posted and is available for our immunization grantees. Of course, for all this to work, everything has to be in place, these aren't all the critical success factors, but it's a few of them anyway, that there still have to be in-network providers to deliver immunization services to insured people. And in some communities, you know, I think that's probably going to be an issue. So, what role public health is going to play in that, I think we need to sort out. There need to be adequate reimbursement rates for immunization providers. And although the Affordable Care Act mandates first dollar coverage for insured people, it doesn't say anything about reimbursement rates as far as I know. So if those reimbursement rates are not adequate to really cover costs, then there still may be problems with availability of services. And then finally, this issue of health department billing for services delivered to insured persons is really going to be critical. To the extent that that health departments need to continue to be in the service delivery business for that insured population, in those communities where that's important, it will be important for health departments to be able to bill insurance. And again, this is something we've been supporting through ERA and hope to be able to do in an ongoing way. There's still uncertainties. We don't know for sure how everything is going to play out regarding the Affordable Care Act. But where we want to end up is using all the tools available to us, the coverage that's available to insured people under the Affordable Care Act, the wonderful benefit the Vaccines for Children program provides to uninsured and Medicaid-eligible children, as well as Alaskan Native and American Indian children, and the gaps that 317 we hope will still continue to be able to provide to protect our communities from vaccine-preventable diseases. It's also important that we maintain and improve our capacity to respond to public health threats, whether it be an outbreak of measles or pertussis and the next pandemic or something else where our public health infrastructure really needs to be there to respond. And, of course, the need to protect the most vulnerable in our communities. As Dr. Fagy said Monday night, if we don't do it, who will? This is public health's role and responsibility. And as we think about the program going forward, that's an ongoing need that we will all need to address. Thank you.